There are at least two critically important principles that are sacred to the true theosophist, whether a member of the society or not. These are, in my view, a relentless pursuit of truth and a life of compassion. I hope in the next hour we can ponder these ideas, meditate on them, dwell on them, rather than analyze them, which I must do to a certain extent to get points across. And moreover, I hope and almost implore you as a fellow student to make every effort to keep those two principles in front of you through the whole spiritual journey. Let's begin with trying to distinguish between belief and certain knowledge. Contrary to the belief systems of most religions that are offered for us to accept, the theosophical view is that each individual must discover the spiritual nature within himself. It must be our experience rather than simply a belief. That is a very strong theosophical view. Discover it for yourself. Look at our objects. Investigate. Study. Comparative study. Investigate. All those things. Yet even we theosophists, as human beings, conditioned human beings, as every single one of us is, we tend to create a belief system out of what we've been told, what we've read, what we've heard from someone we think might know more than we do. Or a contemporary prominent member of the theosophist we might accept. We accept authority figures, don't we tend to do that? H.P. Blavatsky, well, we'll see what she says. I'm all for it. Please don't misunderstand me. But then her words become final wisdom. Don't we all fall into this trap? I hope I'm not alone in this. Or we take Mrs. Besson or a contemporary speaker in the society. In less than 25 years after the founding of the society, K.H. noticed that the members were forming a creed, a belief system, and he objected to it strenuously. While saying they had no dogma and believing that, they were accepting what they heard and then feeling that they understood the truth. Now, this is a double-edged sword. I'm getting to the other side of it in a minute. H.P. Blavatsky insisted that truth could not be taught in words, and she's not alone in that. Other great teachers have said the same. The teacher can but point the way, says the voice of the silence. Words can point. They do point, and they're important pointers. They can help us focus our mind in a particular direction, aim the mind. Our job is to see that's what they are. They're pointers. They're not the truth itself. Belief and theory is not sufficient in and of itself. In fact, when the words and the theories degenerate into a crystallized belief system, they actually block understanding. There's a very simple example that you can all relate to. Every single one of you have had the experience. You're driving with a friend who is going to take you to his home. You've never been there. It's a different town. Well, he describes the home to you as you're going along. How many rooms, what the color is, what the neighborhood is like. What do we all do? Don't we form a picture? Sure we do. Where do we get that picture? Out of our experience, don't we? We've seen homes with multiple rooms and stories, and we've seen front lawns, and we've seen neighborhoods, sort of more or less like he describes. But when we get there, it doesn't look like we thought it did, does it? Never does. Different than we believed. In the same way, when we hear a spiritual doctrine or read a spiritual doctrine, we form an idea of what that means out of our own experience. But we haven't had the experience that the individual is speaking of. So we form an idea, and it is inevitably false. It's a two-edged sword. The theory points the mind. Very, very important to have a direction. But that's not the end. It's the means. We are not meant to drop theosophical theories to come to an awakening of the inner self. We are not meant to drop reasonable assumptions about the nature of reality. The adepts themselves speculate, they say, on what goes on beyond our solar system. They say they don't know out of personal experience. They claim, and I believe them, there's a belief, but it's a reasonable belief in my mind, they claim to know how this system works, this solar system, but from the inside out, subjective and objective, spiritually and physically, they know how it works, its principles. They say beyond the borders of the solar system, we have no personal experience, but we assume that the laws do not break down. So it's fine to speculate with reason, with some evidence, with some support for what we are observing and our conclusions. Now, we are asked not to drop the theories, but to realize that the theories are like maps. Maps are very useful. Maps are very important and very accurate, aren't they? Some of them. We are asked to realize the difference between the map and the place. Now we come to how these two principles that I mentioned, the pursuit of truth, relentless pursuit of truth, and compassion, actually lead to the, in my view, lead to the awakening of the inner self. The first of these, the relentless pursuit of truth, is actually implied in our object. There is no religion higher than truth. The very motto of the society implies this pursuit, doesn't it? And it is also clearly enunciated in what you heard recently as the first qualification on the spiritual life, discrimination. But, there's always a but, isn't there? There's always a dark side as well as the light side. What is truth? When Pilate asked Jesus that question, he did not answer. Perhaps because while ideas, theories, and especially opinions can be put into words, truth cannot. In the Golden Stairs, two of the requirements for reaching the temple of divine wisdom are an open mind and an eager intellect. Now, to me, the temple of divine wisdom is synonymous with the depths of the inner self. Do we have an open mind? I don't want you to answer. Think about it. Are we really willing to look carefully and impartially and objectively and without reacting to evidence that might contradict our precious beliefs? That's not easy. But the real theosophist, at least the one who's making an effort to be a real theosophist, tries to do that. Very easy to have an open mind about someone else's theories with which we do not agree. Not so easy to have evidence contradict ours. Perhaps something even more important. It came out in a meeting earlier on Friday. We may form very false assumptions about ourselves and take no evidence to the contrary. Are we willing to have an open mind? And that's the passive side, the active side, the eager intellect to get to the truth of it, regardless of the consequences. There is the rub. Now, if we persist in holding on to the beliefs that we have in spite of evidence that contradicts them, not holding on to the beliefs when all evidence points that they're accurate, holding on to beliefs in spite of evidence that contradicts them, good, solid evidence, clear evidence, we run the danger of falling into the trap of what K.H. called a dangerous selfishness in the higher principles. As an example of that, he states the following. There are persons, quote, so intensely absorbed in the contemplation of their own supposed righteousness that nothing can ever appear right to them outside the focus of their own vision and their judgment of the right and wrong. Now, the adepts claim that they believe and teach only what they can prove for themselves. They have speculations based on very good evidence, but they don't teach their speculations. Only what they know for absolute certain. That's what they say. I believe them. In fact, if any member of their brotherhood, any other adept, should come upon a principle that appears to be a discovery of something new, that's been there all the time, but that hasn't been discovered, no adept will accept it without verification and re-verification. Those statements are in their letters. Clearly, none of us are adepts. If they will not accept any doctrine, even from another adept, without verification, why should we? They reject blind belief, and they encourage us to do the same. Now, I emphasize again the other side of this. The theories are critically important. They wrote letters and they gave their teachings, which to us are theories. I'm not putting that down. I'm trying to differentiate the difference between understanding to a certain extent a theory, getting a sense of something, and actually experiencing the truth of it within yourself. That's the difference I'm trying to point out. The difference between the map and the place. Here's what one of the adepts wrote about a chela. A chela is a special student. Not special, it's a special relationship between the adept and the student, and that's called a chela, a very close relationship between the student and the teacher. And he said this about chelas. The chela is at perfect liberty and often quite justified from the standpoint of appearances to suspect his guru, that's the adept, of being a fraud. The greater, the sincerer his indignation, whether expressed in words or boiling in his heart, the more fit he is, the better qualified to become an adept. He is free to use the most abusive language, words, and expressions regarding his guru's actions and orders, provided he resists all and every temptation, rejects every allurement, and proves that nothing, not even the promise of his future adeptship, is able to make him deviate from the path of truth and honesty. That's a powerful statement. They don't want gullible believers, they say. They want inquirers, searchers, who will push and stretch the mind to the infinite. Now, to begin this pursuit of truth from the theosophical view, I'm sorry to say we must be humble. Real humility. C.S. Lewis put it better than anyone in his Screwtape Letters, with which some of you are familiar. Delightful little book, not very long. Please do treat yourself to it sometime. It has every human foible in it, and you're going along saying, aha, I know somebody like that, and you go, oh, that's me. And it's a senior devil in hell writing to a junior tempter on earth about how to get the patient away from the enemy, capital E. And he points out various things, and the junior tempter's name is Wormwood, so he writes, my dear Wormwood, I see your patient has become humble. Have you reminded him of the fact? And he goes on with that for a bit, and then he ends up saying, never, 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 never let your patient realize that true humility is being able to build the most magnificent cathedral on earth, or give the greatest theosophical talk, and feel about it precisely the same as if his neighbor had done it. Isn't that wonderful? That's humility, not a beautiful human being saying they're ugly. That's stupid. There are mirrors. Or a brilliant person saying they're stupid. Then they really are if they say that. It's that attitude of the joy of the creation. The speaker is a listener. As the speaker, as a great artist, great artists often say this. They may be absolute pains in you know where in their personal life and very, very difficult people, but when they perform well, the great artists often say, it came through me and not from me. And that's what happens with therapeutic touch. People sometimes say to me, oh, I don't want to take your energy. I say, don't worry, I'm not giving you any. I feel better after I treat somebody. That's a side effect. It's not why I'm doing it, but it happens automatically because the energy goes through you. So humility is necessary. The doctrine of the I, says the voice of the silence, is for the crowd. That's just the theoretical stuff, as I understand it. Only, important as it is. The doctrine of the heart for the elect. The first, repeat in pride, behold, I know. The last, they who in humbleness have garnered, lo, confess, thus have I heard. Further in the voice of the silence, be humble if thou wouldst attain to wisdom. Be humbler still when wisdom thou hast mastered. Be like the ocean which receives all streams and rivers. The ocean's mighty calm remains unmoved. It feels them not. Now, there's a very curious relationship between wisdom or truth, capital T, to me is the same as wisdom, and the inner self. More than a relationship, it is an identity. I have an authority statement for this from the voice of the silence, and an intuitive sense of it myself, and many, many, many others have as well. The voice of the silence reads, have perseverance as one who doth forevermore endure. Thy shadows live and vanish. That which in thee shall live forever, that which in thee knows, for it is knowledge, is not a fleeting life. It is the man that was, that is, and will be, for whom the hour shall never strike. If that inner self is knowledge, is truth, then the relentless pursuit of truth is a pursuit of that self and its awakening to conscious action in us. Now to compassion. The search for truth and compassion are, I believe, intricately woven together. Mrs. Besant once said, love is the response that comes from a realization of oneness. I've never heard it put better. We look at someone we love, at our cat, at our dog, and for a moment, there's a tremendous realization of unity, isn't there? Now, you don't think of it intellectually, or you're not united. Then there's you and the cat and your thought. But for the moment, there's just a unity, isn't there? And instantly on realization of that unity, there's a rush of feeling that we call love. It's a natural consequence to that realization. Compassion, I believe, is impersonal love. Mrs. Besant was describing, I think, maybe she wasn't, but she's not here to defend herself, love of an individual. Compassion is an impersonal love, perhaps for an individual, but usually it's thought of more as universal. And compassion, from my point of view, comes from a realization of a greater unity. There's a prayer recited at every service of the liberal Catholic Church. I don't know whether the more traditional branches of the church have it or not. Teach us, O Lord, to see thy life in all men and in all the peoples of thine earth. That's a noble idea, however phrased. Now, while the search for knowledge, if our pursuit is for knowledge rather than truth, while the search for knowledge alone may lead to selfishness, the search for truth, I believe, leads toward a realization of ultimate unity. Leads toward, doesn't produce. And the response to that realization is compassion. The most powerful statement I have ever read, it pierces the very heart, is in the voice of the silence. Let thy soul lend its ear to every cry of pain. Like as the lotus bears its heart to drink the morning sun, let not the fierce sun dry one tear of pain before thyself hast wiped it from the sufferer's eye. But let each burning human tear drop on thy heart and there remain, nor ever brush it off until the pain that caused it is removed. These two principles, the relentless pursuit of truth and compassion, are to me the hallmarks of the true theosophist. And they lead to an awakening of the inner self, which results, I believe, in a compassionate, altruistic life, and in the regenerating practical brotherhood that the adepts say they want. Now, motive in our search is extremely important. One of the adepts once wrote, "Motive is everything to us." If in our search we are motivated by the hope of personal gain, I think we are laying up treasures on earth where moth and rust doth corrupt. But if we are motivated by what HPB calls an inexpressible longing for the infinite, then I think we cannot go wrong. The great search requires study. It requires meditation. It requires service. It requires forgetting self. But what do we mean when we say it requires study? Study is not merely, from my view, reading books, taking courses, listening to lectures, and taking notes on it all. That is very useful, I must hasten to emphasize. If I didn't think so, I wouldn't stand up here and try to convey some ideas, or go and listen to others. It is useful. But study to me is not just that. Study to me means an intense longing to understand. That's what it is. Mrs. Besant once said, "Read a little, think a lot." Partly to my shame, that's what I've done. I don't read much. But partly to my credit, I've done the second part of it. I think a lot. And I assure you that most of what I know, if I know anything at all, has come from that. It's happened to me and millions of others because we're human, not because we're special. So that pushing of the mind to understand, taking a theory that somehow triggers something, and somehow in the back of your mind something says, hey, there's something to that. You may be wrong, you may be right. Okay, as John pointed out, that wonderful, delicious quote that I love as well as John does of Milton, of consider you may be mistaken. That's a possibility, but consider also you may be right. Find out. So that longing to understand what's meant by this, all these wonderful theosophical ideas, the polarization of the universe, how that affects the world, et cetera, is it true or isn't it true, is there any evidence? You push and push and push. In The Voice of the Silence, which I read when I joined the society back in 1959, I read shortly afterward, And you'll have the same experience with that or other books that are meaningful books, powerful books, sensible books. A lot of it didn't mean anything to me. And now, a lot of it still doesn't. But a lot of it does. One thing I repeat to myself frequently, be humble if thou wouldst attain to wisdom, be humbler still when wisdom thou hast mastered. And another one, which didn't mean much to me, practically nothing when I joined, but means a lot now. Restrain by thy divine thy lower self. Restrain by the eternal the divine. So study to me is that longing to understand, not to gain something, but to understand. And study in that sense to me is a type of meditation. And meditation is both a state of mind and an action of search. It's a probing. It's a longing to be united with the infinite. And by that central focus and inner longing, there is the possibility of discovering the truth of it in oneself. Service is the inevitable consequence. I think sometimes people look at these three limbs of the theosophical life, study, meditation, and service. Oh, what should I study? Oh, this, that, the other thing. Oh, how should I meditate? What should I meditate on? Oh, how should I serve? Should I do this or should I do that? At the risk of stating an error, I don't think that's it. That longing is the sine qua non, that without which nothing. And the service is what you can't help but doing. It's not something you might look for ways you can help because you have to help. It's not because, oh, I see, if I am to be enlightened or awaken the inner self, I have to serve. So let me go work in a hospital or work for the Theosophicals. The motive, you see. But once there's some realization or closeness or nearness to that inner reality, service is almost obligatory. One can't do anything else, and one doesn't think anything about it or think they're humble, though they are. We had ages ago in the Liberal Catholic Church a very old lady. Well, she was old when I met her. She was obviously young at one time. And she didn't have the greatest intellect in the world, but she had a compassionate and sensible heart. And she worked as a nurse all night and came to the church in the morning, like got off at 8 in the morning and hung around and had her breakfast Horn and Hardart's, and then came to the Mass and played the organ. And people admired her for this, and they used to say, oh, Susan, you give such wonderful service. This woman was truly, truly humble in the real sense of the word. She used to get annoyed if they went on about this. She said, oh, stop it, I'm just doing what I want to do. She didn't see why anybody thought it was anything great. She used to feed the animals as cats, actually. She loved cats. She herself was a vegetarian, but she used to go and get meat from the butcher for the cats. And she'd give it to them on the Long Island Railroad station platform, the one where she got on to come into the city. And one day, a man accosted her and said, why do you feed those filthy animals? Why don't you do something for children instead? I said, Susan, what did you say? She said, I do. I work in a hospital all night. What do you do? I never forgot it. So it requires study. It requires meditation, the probing, the quietness of the mind, quieting the mind, and then the probing, the longing, the searching, and the realization that the ultimate self is always beyond. I think if we can do that, we can awaken the inner self. Now, at the first awakening, I think it's a wee bit like awakening toward dawn for a moment and then falling back to sleep. We can't sustain it. It comes in flashes, and when it comes, for a fleeting eternity, you are one with the infinite. The response that comes from that is joy, certain, unimpeachable knowledge, bliss, and a peace that passes understanding. It's a fleeting eternity because as we retreat to brain consciousness, it fades. But it's never forgotten. Not ever. Now, we mustn't be fooled into thinking that because we have had such an experience, that we have, as HPB put it, won the victory. Because, I'm sorry to say, that's when the really difficult work begins. It's not when it ends. And that task, the arduous task, is to gain complete mastery over the personality. Self-transformation of that type cannot occur in a flash. It cannot occur in a week, a year, or one lifetime, according to the adept. It takes lifetimes. So to follow the spiritual path is not easy. Yet if we persevere to the end, I believe we can. We can reach the temple of divine wisdom. We can awaken the inner self if we try. I want to end in the way I ended another talk once, with a statement by H.P. Blavatsky, and she's called There Is a Road. And at the end of the first verse of it, it's rather short, she says the road leads to the very heart of the universe. That's another way of saying the ultimate depth of the inner self. HPB was very realistic. She never promised us the rose garden, but she also said, you can do it. Both were true. Tough, painful even, agonizing even, and yet the rewards beyond telling. So in this effort to awaken the inner self, she says more beautifully than I could, there is a road steep and thorny, beset with perils of every kind, but yet a road, and it leads to the very heart of the universe. I can tell you how to find those who will show you the secret gateway that opens inwardly only and closes fast behind the neophyte forevermore. There is no danger that dauntless courage cannot conquer. There is no trial that spotless purity cannot pass through. There is no difficulty that strong intellect cannot surmount. For those who win onward, there is reward past all telling, the power to bless and save humanity. For those who fail, there are other lives in which success may come.
Could you explain more? Is there something about restraint?
Well, I tell you, I'm not trying to cop out on that, but I think that's one of those things that's near impossible to describe without some sort of inner sense of it. It's that there are, I can put it this way in words perhaps, we're compound creatures as human beings. All of us know that. We can have experience, consciousness of our physical body, consciousness of our emotional state, of our mental state, and we can have glimpses of the spiritual nature. And I've mentioned earlier that from my view, and I think from the literature supports that view, that there's always beyond. Even the adepts look up to some others who know more than they do. They believe no more than they do, so they defer to their judgment when it is in matters that they feel their judgment is better than their superior's judgment is better than theirs. And I feel that in our nature there is an awakening of the inner self, could I dare say, at the risk of being completely wrong, at one level of the inner self we awaken, there's an awakening. But then one gets a greater sense not only of that, but of something that is beyond all, that is truly unspeakable and unthinkable. And it's almost as though that has to finally have preeminence and gain mastery. That's very badly put probably and misleading, but that's about the best I can do, that there are these doubt. And in meditation, over the years, if you persist in it and you really have that central motive of longing for union with the infinite, I believe that you come to understand a little more of what that means within yourself.
And it seems like what I hear you talking about is a way of orienting ourselves in the world as theosophists. And but I just wonder, as a New Yorker, how you would place your thoughts in the context of the world we live in after September 11th.
We could see the World Trade Center as we crossed our street, 38th Street and 5th Avenue. We could see it. My wife worked 10 blocks from there. She fortunately got on the cell phone before all cell phones ceased to work and said she was all right, and she walked home, which is about 5 miles, but that's nothing for a New Yorker. We walk more than most of you. The first thing I did was meditate. I meditate every day of my life, but I've never meditated so much and so often as I did for the first couple of weeks after that happened. And instead of anger and hatred, which I believe fuels violence, I made every effort to be extremely still. And for the first few days in New York, I don't think that people in the city suddenly started to meditate. I really think that would be silly to say they didn't. I think they were more stunned, but they were quiet. For 3 days or so, even in Midtown Manhattan where I live, people walked rather quietly. You didn't hear cell phones. You didn't hear horns. There was no frustration and annoyance at traffic. You didn't hear arguments. People walked quietly. After about 3 or 4 days, I heard some horns out front, and I ran to the window, and I said to Mary, I didn't think I'd ever live to hear myself say it, but I'm glad to see the traffic. So I felt, and I even said when I taught a Scottish dance class the very next Monday, it's not appropriate to speak theosophy or philosophy or religion in a Scottish dance class, and I never do, but that night I thought I should say something when I started the class, and I said that I thought that all of us should make a supreme effort to try to be very, very quiet within ourselves and to think of peace and to send peace for what it was worth. So how New York reacted, it runs the gamut, because as you know, New York has the sublime and the ridiculous. It sort of has everything except lots of space and nature, and it has its own sort of culture, which is different from others, et cetera, et cetera. So people reacted differently. Mary saw the towers go down. She was on the way home and saw that. But we all meditated together. Yeah. In case you didn't hear that, the gist of it, if I get it right, and if not, you'll tell me. She refers to the quote that I read about the chela, or the student in special relationship with the adept, where he said that they were right to question his teachings and even to be boiling with anger if they felt that what he was saying wasn't true and wasn't right, and that the important thing was not to believe or disbelieve what the guru said, but to let nothing stop you from the pursuit of truth and honesty, to be true and honest, to find truth and to be honest. That's what they regarded as a great quality, a quality that potentially could lead you to the level that they are at, adeptship, or to the knowledge or the understanding that they've achieved. And she contrasted that with a lot of the alleged, may I use that word, gurus that we read about, and many people just believe. Now, many of these teachers are wise. I don't say they're not. Many of them have been helpful to people, I'm sure. Temperamentally, perhaps, I'm just not anybody. I just never was built to kiss anybody's feet, and I would get sick to my stomach if anybody tried to kiss mine. I just can't do it. I'm a Scorpio.
One of the things that I think when that goes sort of thought, when those thoughts go through my mind, is that because I do read so many bits and pieces and letters and little writings in the course of my work, hear that sort of thing in HPB's writings and in the early Theosophists. And then it seems like later on the tone.
Well, that's sort of what I began with, that we Theosophists also create a creed, and that's what the Adept was saying. And some of the later writers had a lot to offer. I have great admiration for Mrs. Besson and some of the other later writers and current ones. But as is often the case in great movements, and I think the Theosophical movement is a great movement, those who found it are wiser than those who follow. Isn't that often the case? But they always say, you too can do this. Even in the Pauline epistles, Christ is our elder brother. And one line says, has Christ saying to us, you will do greater things than I. Well, I don't think anyone except Theosophists believe that. Christians don't believe that. And yet Jesus said it, allegedly. Nobody knows what the poor man did say, but anyway, he allegedly said that. Oh, yeah, I just meant this traditional fundamentalist type. So thank you for the correction. Of course there are Christian Theosophists who don't look at it that way, of course. We were talking earlier that there's a wide variety of interpretation in any tradition. I mean, we have everything from Jehovah's Witnesses to Roman Catholics in the Christian tradition and all sorts of things in between. And they don't all agree, and they have different views, and some have a much broader view and perhaps a much deeper understanding. That's one of the great values of scriptures. They are really poetry, they're metaphor, even though they might use history. And it can be interpreted differently depending on our level of understanding. Anyway, keep in mind, pursuit of truth at all costs, even if it hurts, and the life of compassion.